Welcome to In His Footsteps with award-winning author Margaret Agard, sharing practical tips for living a joy-filled life and amazing interviews with people who do. Now here's Margaret.
Do you think the service organization you work for could just do a better job if you could just get more money in? Today, Marty Title, who has worked on both sides of the grant-making industry, both getting grants and giving grants, is going to share with you how to find grants, get them, and the biggest mistakes people make.
Now here's this week's Bible question and answer, brought to you by the Amazing Bible Timeline. Quickly see 6,000 years of Bible and world history together on one color-coded wall poster. Find out more about the Amazing Bible Timeline or ask your own Bible question at AmazingBibleTimeline.com.
The Bible question this week is, when is the beautiful Queen Esther on the Bible timeline? And here's another question. Who came first, the prophet Daniel or Esther? D comes before E, and Daniel came before Esther. Daniel was living during the time when the Medes and Persians invaded and destroyed Judah and took them captive. Esther was living nearly 100 years later under the rule of the Medes and the Persians, and most likely was married to the Persian king Xerxes. Okay, how to get money for your nonprofit or service organization? And have you ever thought about grants but thought, nah, that's too hard. I can't do that. I think it takes someone with a college degree and getting grants to get those grants. Today, Marty Title is going to explain to you how to get grants, how to get small grants for small organizations, where to find that money, and the biggest mistakes to avoid.
Hello.
Hi, Marty. It's Margaret Agard.
Well, hi. How are you doing?
But just go ahead and confirm. You've actually worked both with nonprofits and with the who are looking for grants and with foundations who give grants. Is that correct?
That's true. Yes. Yes, that's right. I would say if you want to go by years, maybe more than half has been with funders and the rest with people who are nonprofits and seek funding from the outside.
Marty, the first question is, do you have to be set up as a nonprofit? Do you have to be set up as a 501c3 in order to get grants?
Legally, no, but in practicality, it's really rare. I worked for a foundation starting in the late 70s that made grants to community groups that were not incorporated and didn't have that 501c3 status, but the vast, vast majority of funders require it.
Okay.
So it's less the government than it is the people who have the money want the security of knowing that you've passed a certain set of standards.
Okay. All right, so then that kind of narrows the groups I'm talking with right now or that are listening right now. But, you know, there are those out there, like if you're a Girl Scout troop or whatever, there's that or an animal shelter.
If we stay just with community groups get money mostly from, if they're doing a good job, I think, they get money mostly from the communities that they serve and then somewhat from governments and foundations and corporations and churches. I would say those are the main sources of money.
Okay. Well, why should people? Well, first of all, I think most people don't go after grants, but it does look like a nice way to go if you can figure out how to get the money. But why should grant money only be a part of the mix?
There's several reasons, and I think this is just the key question. There's security in having a large number of small donors versus a small number of large donors. So inevitably, certain people are just going to get mad or lose interest or change their priorities and go away. If you have four big foundations funding you and two of them change their minds, you're in deep trouble. If you have 200 community members and two of them change their minds, frankly, you're just not even going to notice.
Right.
There's great security. Having a lot of people who give you $25 enables you to weather the storm a lot better than having a small number of people, one of whom can just cripple an organization.
Well, that's good to know. I think the question I also had was, or you pointed out in your book, that foundations actually have guidelines they have to go by. And so you have to fit in those guidelines. And if you decide to change the focus of your organization, you may not fit in those guidelines anymore. That you can't just go to a foundation and say, here's a good idea. It has to be, here's a good idea, and it fits in your guidelines. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Now, another point that you made was that, I was comparing it to construction companies, is that you wouldn't go to a construction company that builds airports and nuclear power plants and ask them to remodel your kitchen. And so by the same token, you wouldn't go to these large foundations that we've all heard about and ask them for, you know, a $500 grant for your local project.
Well, I really wish I thought of having a nuclear power plant company remodel your kitchen. What a great figure of speech that is. It's just perfect that you have to get the scale, you have to get it right. The amount of money that it costs the foundation to staff a grant is more or less the same. So if I'm going to give you $500 or $5,000 or $500,000, more or less the amount of work, the cost to the foundation is the same. And so from their point of view, it's just not that cost effective to make little grants. And making little grants is kind of specialized. It's a different sort of scrutiny than if you're looking at a big laboratory or, you know, a college department or something like that. So what some foundations do is they do this wholesale retail where they take a chunk of money and they may say, for example, we're very concerned about there being computers in rural schools. And so we're going to give $5 million spread out over 50 states through these organizations or departments or whatever it is. And because they really have their finger on the pulse locally, they will be the retail distributors of our $5 million, maybe in $500 chunks.
So how do we find people like that or organizations like that? Like, because I would think most people here, and while you're answering that question, maybe answer the same question. Would it make more sense then to ask for 500, thinking, well, we don't want to ask for too much, or to go for the 5,000, because actually they'd rather give you 5,000?
Oh, you're raising two huge questions. This is so much what people want to know, is how much do I ask for, and how do I find out who to ask? How do I find out who to ask? I think the best way of doing it, and it makes some people really nervous, but I don't think there are any ethical problems. The best way to do it is to find organizations in your area who are in some way similar to you and find out who funds them. People often put it on their website. They put it in their annual report. They publish a statement that they'll make available. It's on their tax returns, which are usually publicly accessible, and nowadays you can find them on the Internet. You say, okay, so we're a community organization that's concerned about animal welfare, and you get the statements of who has been supporting animal welfare in your state or in your county or in your community, and how much have they given. You go by what has already worked. There's no reason to reinvent the wheel. And I think that's back in the days when I worked for nonprofits, I was an avid collector of the annual reports of my peers. And if you're in good shape with your peers, you can collaborate. I had good friends who directed other nonprofits, and we shared our lists of potential funders. And I think it's a wonderful kind of collaboration. People get nervous about it because they think that, well, I'm going to steal the money from under the nose of my colleagues. I look at it more as community collaboration, and that it really is and should be public information. So
you get out and know the people either right in your area or in your same state in a different area. Or area, maybe like in a regional too, say, well, what are they doing for us in West Virginia? What's happening in Kentucky? These same kinds of organizations. And you're saying online, they probably have listed where they got it from, or in their tax returns, they have to show where they got the money from and how much came from where.
Absolutely. And if you're worried about competing with people, you know, I live in a very rural state, and so there are not many duplicates for community organizations. So you're right. If here in Lincoln County, I may not get the annual reports of people I'm competing with, but I'd go over to Knox County or Cumberland County, and there would be very similar organizations, and I could look at, well, who's supporting them.
Okay.
So I would start with that, and I think that there are also good directories and online resources. The directories are in the libraries, but increasingly online. I know, again, in my state up here in Maine, there are some organizations that have taken the trouble to collect who those funders are. The Maine Community Foundation makes grants, but also provides resources to support nonprofits, even tiny nonprofits. So I think the information is out there, and I think part of finding out who is finding out how much.
Right. So, because that would be there. This is about how much they give. If you're just joining us, this is Margaret Agard with In His Footsteps. Have you ever tried to get money for an organization and thought about going after grants, but it seemed too hard? Today, Marty Teitel, the author of the book, The Ultimate Insider's Guide to Winning Foundation Grants, who actually used to head up a foundation and also worked with nonprofits getting grants, shares how to get the money. Right now, I just wanted to ask him, well, how do you know how much to ask for?
It's really not a bad thing to simply ask. When I was a funder, I appreciated that question because it was so discouraging when people were very, very far off base. It could cause me a lot of problems if I wanted to try to get them a grant. So I think asking a funder, here's this proposal, how much should I ask for? Or is this range one that's comfortable for you? Or is there another range that I should use? I think that that openness and honesty and collaborative spirit holds a lot of funders.
Okay. You know, I hear it takes a full-time person just to get grants. Is that true?
Well, no.
Okay.
I think that it's terribly important to involve an organization as widely as you possibly can in controlling its own resources. If you have one person or a small number of people who control the resources, they're going to have a greater power. It's going to unbalance the organization. If everybody feels like, again, I go to churches as an example. If everybody feels like, you know, I brought something to the bake sale, I put money in the collection plate, you've spread out the feeling of power over the organization's direction and fate, rather than having people who say, I don't like that idea, and I'm the one with the pathway to the money. Now, that said, I think it is vitally important to designate one person to be the coordinator of funding efforts. If you don't do that, you're going to have the same organization send two funding requests to the same funder, which is just death. And
okay.
You're going to miss deadlines and you're going to miss reports. So I think it does need a single person who is the czar of funding, but the power needs to be as dispersed as possible.
Okay. Well, would you recommend taking a workshop? I mean, because people don't know. They're like, oh, I don't know. Like, if I wanted to start getting a grant, I'd be like, you know, I don't even know how to start.
Sure. I would say take a workshop if you do your homework really, really, really well, because there are some excellent people who provide resources. And there are some people who have a kind of canned presentation, and they travel around, and they charge a lot of money, and it's just like your example of hiring someone who's used to building factories to remodel your kitchen. You may get someone who just doesn't fit the needs of West Virginia, whose values and scale and assumptions about how you do things are too predetermined. And then you're going to pay a lot of money for a very small return. So I feel very wary of just signing up for one of those things. I think it's worth it if you can satisfy yourself mostly by talking with people who you know who have already done it.
Right. Or maybe say, would you give a workshop if I could get 20 people to show up? And some local person who's been very successful at it. I'm thinking of one man in particular who seems to be very successful at getting money.
Well,
yeah.
And sometimes the most successful ones are the ones who are just, as you say, they get 20 people together. They're the most informal. The people who charge $695 for a weekend with a whole lot of fancy slides and notebooks that are already packaged before they ever show up in your town. Sometimes that makes me nervous, but if you meet a friend and she says, I just went to this workshop and I got so much out of it, it was terrific, well, then if it were me, I'd sign right up.
Okay. Well, what are the five mistakes? Well, you know what? First, talk about the process, because in your book, you were making it clear there's like first there's the letter of inquiry, and then I assume people say, sure, go ahead and send us a proposal. So next you do the proposal, and don't confuse those two things. Is that correct? And how do you do that?
Well, I think, again, and you know, we don't live in an ideal world. Ideally, what I hope people would do is sit down and say, what do we want to get done in the world? And second, what resources do we need to get that done? And then third, where are we going to get those resources? And I've been in nonprofits enough where you, in the real world, you sit there and you say, oh my goodness, how are we going to meet payroll? So
right.
I think that there's you have to be realistic, and that in the best of all worlds, you start with what you want to get done and work down to the proposal, but the proposal is just kind of a reflection of who you are and where you're going. In the real world, you find out that your local community foundation, I mean, I've been involved with a local nonprofit where we got wind of a special granting program from the local community foundation, and the deadline was next Wednesday, and we worked late into the night for several days completing that application and slamming it out the door so we could meet the deadline, and we didn't spend a lot of time having deep philosophical discussions.
Right.
This is a poor, struggling local nonprofit, and we just worked and worked and worked and worked till late at night for several nights. And by the way, we didn't get the grant.
Oh, okay. Well, what are the five mistakes people make in trying to get grants?
Well, I'll give you the answer, but I want to say that I don't want to sound real critical. I think these are mistakes that people make not because they're bad, but because they're not professional fundraisers, thank heavens.
Okay.
So, but these are things that people do just because of
ignorance.
Of not knowing how things go in the foundation business, and that's never a criticism.
Before we go on with that, let me just take a bit of break.
Yeah.
And just, you know, mention, if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Martin Teitel, who worked on both sides of the grants, as with a nonprofit looking for grants and with a foundation giving grants, has decades of experience with this. He's written a book called The Ultimate Insider's Guide to Winning Foundation Grants, and he's sharing some of the secrets on how to go about getting grants. And the reason I mentioned the book is because you're going to hear a lot of information. It's easy to forget. So it's all put together in this book. Okay. So talk about those five mistakes.
Yes. And these are the things that I learned after reading thousands of funding requests over 30-something years of being a funder. I think the number one mistake that people make is they talk at great length and in great detail about problems. And then they are not very detailed about solutions. But what persuades funders is not that the problem is bad, but that you have come up with a way of addressing it. Maybe not fixing it, but at least dealing with it.
Okay.
And then I think the second thing that's kind of related to that is that people get very specific about the problems, but when they get into solutions, the solutions don't actually fit how you would change that problem. People talk about homelessness, but then they say, well, what we're going to do about it is something that when you're just reading the proposal, you think, well, what does that have to do with homelessness? So why does having meetings or holding a conference, what does that have to do with it? So that matching the solution to the problem in a compelling way is the second thing. I think the third thing that, oh my goodness, just used to drive me crazy was a huge use of buzzwords and jargon and people trying to kind of snow you with technical terms instead of just talking like one ordinary person addressing another ordinary person. You're just talking to some guy who's doing a job or some woman who's doing a job behind a desk, and people sometimes...
Pretend you're telling your neighbor. Pretend you're telling your neighbor and then just tell him. Yeah.
Exactly. That's just exactly right.
I'll have you share some more common mistakes people make going after grants after this request, Marty.
If you like this show and want to help us keep it on the air, please send your donation, any amount will help, to Margaret Parker, LC, In His Footsteps Radio, Post Office Box 173, Duck, West Virginia, 25063, or go online to donate using debit or credit cards, or PayPal, www.inhisfootsteps.com. Thank you for your help keeping us on the air. Now here's Margaret.
Back to Dr. Marty Teitel. Author of The Ultimate Insider's Guide to Winning Foundation Grants, the last two most common mistakes people make going after grants.
Another thing that happened with amazing frequency was people sending in budgets and financial material that didn't add up. And if you're asking for money, but you can't submit a financial statement that adds up, just like that the bottom of the column reflects all the numbers in it, I mentioned earlier staying up till late at night doing this fast proposal for the local foundation, and we went through the numbers about 10 times picking up mistakes because you're tired, you're in a rush, it's late. But at the end of the day, when the decision makers are sitting there and they catch you with that mistake, it can kill a completely wonderful proposal instantly. So we've got to check the math. I know that sounds like a small thing, but it's really a big thing.
If you have an accountant, have them run through those numbers.
Yeah, and spreadsheets, I don't know, I'm not a good spreadsheet person, but getting someone involved who actually really truly knows how to do spreadsheets and who can make sure that you're presenting your financial information in a way that's strong and that's clear and that's accurate. Those three things, I think, are very, very important because you're not asking for T-shirts, you're asking for money, and therefore your money part has to be really organized. Then the fifth thing is that people think that if they go online and read my guidelines and then say it back to me, that that's kind of like putting the money in the vending machine and the candy bar is going to drop out the bottom. So we say we're concerned about the plight of young children in small rural communities who don't have access to dental care. I'm just making this up.
Right.
And then someone sends a proposal and says, I'm concerned about the plight of children in small rural communities that don't have access to dental care. Well, that shows that they have a connection to the Internet and they read my website, but that's not enough. Showing that you know the guidelines is not the end thing you should do. It's the first thing you should do.
So you want to make sure you know that yours fits in the guidelines. So you can say, maybe you could say something like, because you're concerned about, and in our community, we have a dentist who comes in once every 3 weeks, and that's not enough, or something like that.
Exactly. So that you're showing that, yeah, you know what the guidelines are, but here's actually what you're doing about it.
Okay. And we're going to have Lala come in every week, if we could get this. Yes. Or if we could set up a building. I see what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay. So you say you should find the funder whose requirements match, and you use these words, strategies and tactics. And strategy, so let's keep with the dental care in small rural communities, because that actually is an issue here in West Virginia. What would a strategy be, and what would a tactic be?
Good. A strategy is that this is one of the things that plagues everybody the most, is the difference between strategies and tactics. A strategy is the name of what you're going to, it's the name of the direction of what you're going to do, and the tactics are what you actually do. So keeping with this example, because I come from a state that also has one of the lowest per capita populations of dentists anywhere, and this is a real issue around here. So
you're in Maine. Maine and West Virginia are pretty, like, sister states in terms of issues.
Yeah. You have less snow, though.
That's true. depending on which part of the state you're in. But yeah.
Well, fair enough. I've mostly been to Charleston, so I'm less snow
there. Great. That's right. Yeah.
Okay, so a strategy. So let's say the problem we've identified that the problem is that children aren't getting adequate dental care. The strategy would be to you could select one of a number of strategies. It could be to increase funding for doctors in rural areas. That would be a strategy. It could be to provide transport for children to dental clinics in nearby towns. A strategy would be to provide dental screening after school in the schools through rotating dentists. I'm just making all this up.
Right.
So let's say you decide, your organization decides that what your strategy is going to be to get kids into nearby towns for checkups. So
okay.
Your tactics are going to be to get a van, to get a driver, to get insurance. The tactics are the specific day-to-day concrete things you do that are inside of your strategy. So
okay.
Your goal is better teeth. Your strategy is getting kids to dentists. Your tactics involve vans, parents, gas, insurance, schedules.
Okay. So I had a question, and I'm not sure that it fits here now, because when I look at what you're saying, when you look at what a funder's guidelines are, I was thinking, well, maybe their guidelines were such that my tactic doesn't fit in, but I could change my tactic. So if I was thinking I was going to take a van and get them to a nearby community, that's one thing, or even my strategy. Maybe I'm saying, really, I'm just concerned about the dental care, and these people want to provide money to have doctors come into my community if you have a clinic. So now I should change my strategy, my tactic. Should I be that flexible or not?
Oh, it's just, you can stay up late at night worrying about this question, because I don't think there's really a good answer to this question. I think that it's one of the reasons why it's crucial to have fundraising dispersed in the organization, to make sure your board and as many staff as possible focus on the question you just asked, because otherwise an individual fundraiser might kind of sell your soul and you don't know about it till the check has arrived, and now you're committed to something that you don't choose to do.
Well, so now we're back to question one, which is, why should I diversify, not put all my money eggs in one funder's basket?
Exactly. And you may decide, you know, if your proposal is trying to get the funder to change what they do, good luck. But if your proposal says, you and I, we share concerns, you're concerned about rural health, children's health in rural areas, and so are we, you're concerned about the shortage of dentists in our state, you've been funding rotating dentists, we've come up with a different approach, how would you like to try moving the kids to the dentist rather than the dentist to the kids, and here's why we think our approach is a good one. Not a better one, but a good one. And you may decide that, the money is available to bring the dentist to our community, so let's give up on a van. Coming up with all the money, even for a used van, is too much. Let's switch over to where the money is, because we can do it, and it would be better for the kids to get dental care than for us to sit on our high horse and insist that everything gets done our way.
All right, Marty, thanks a lot. I'm sure this is going to be very helpful. We have lots of small community groups in here just working on wonderful plans, and hopefully more, because we have a lot of people retiring here. Okay, that was Dr. Marty Teitel, author of The Ultimate Insider's Guide to Winning Foundations Grants, actually a wealth of knowledge, especially if you've never gone after grants before. So thanks for joining us.
You can find out more about how to have the joy that comes from living each day for God while still keeping up with daily life in the book In His Footsteps, How to Be Happy in Every Situation, available at the website inhisfootsteps.com or online at amazon.com.
You can get more information on our guests and our discussion today, including replays of this show, at inhisfootsteps.com. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Margaret Agard. You can reach me at P.O. Box 173, Duck, West Virginia 25063, or through my website, inhisfootsteps.com. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Be sure to join us next week for more practical tips on living a God-directed life and amazing interviews with people who do.